Hello, I'm Alex Goldstein.
And I'm Alex Totoro.
We're a couple of TV nerds with opinions, and this is The Thing That Gets You to The Thing, a Halt and Catch Fire fan podcast.
Today we're on Season 2, Episode 3, called The Way In, which means everyone's looking for a lightbulb moment, but some people can't help tripping a fuse.
As a quick reminder, in case you're new here, we're going episode by episode through the show, looking for the sparks of inspiration that keep us hooked every time we watch.
Okay then, join us in the West Group basement.
So two unusual things have happened here. One is that we watched these episodes back to back. We watched this back to back with the one before. The second is that we're recording these episodes back to back. So we have literally just recorded episode two and we were going, oh, we're not sure if this really entirely held together. And did you feel that episode three found its feet and did hold together? How did you feel about it?
I think it was certainly a little bit better than episode two, probably because there was a lot more boss backstory for some reason. Like, I felt like that really helped bring in new light and something a little bit more exciting. I think the Tom dynamic is also heating up a little bit more. And there's this, obviously, they all get back together in a way. And that really felt like, yes, like these are the moments that we want, right?
Yes. So I really liked this episode. I thought there was a lot to like in this one and it made me feel at home. And to be fair, both of these episodes were written by people who have written for the show before, but I feel like Jason Cahill often gets under the skin of these characters in a way that I really appreciate, that speaks to me a lot. And it was interesting to me that when we got Bruce Cantwell's attention on Twitter, he was saying something about something having been an invention of Jason Cahill's. And it feels like he is the sort of third member of the group, that he kind of gets these guys really, really well. So I thought a lot of the characterization in this was really nice. We talked a lot about in episode two about the show opening up and going outside, because it has to, because you can't keep going around in circles with four people forever without bringing in some outside influence. But I really like that it showed its commitment to Boz as a character in this one and said, okay, we're going to deal with the parts of his life that aren't Cardiff and aren't Mutiny and Gordon and Joe, which I liked a lot in this one. I thought that it spread out further and it earned it as it went along. So yeah, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, and I think already from the very first frames, it's just very dynamic, right? You've got Gordon sort of typing on the computer with some really smooth angles, some lighting coming in, these cans of Jolt, whatever that is. I'm guessing like an 80s off-brand Red Bull, which again, Gordon is the Coke not enough. And you also got Donna kind of, I have a note about this, but like in these stripes throughout, her hair is a little bit different. There's just new energy coming in, I think. And it does really help, because what the show is really good at is just resetting. This feels like it's a little bit of that.
And this has an interesting feel to it. So the director for this is Jeff Freilich. He will go on to direct another couple of episodes, but he was a producer from day one. So he has a handful of directorial credits anyway, but his main job is producer. And so he's been on the show from the beginning, but only now stepping in to the director's seat. And I have to admit, sort of complete sideline tangent, but I was looking up his directorial career and he cut his teeth on Falcon Crest, which was one of my mother's favorite shows. So he was directing shows in the 80s and now he's directing a show about the 80s.
Interesting.
Absolutely. But it felt like he brought a really, like he said, a really nice energy to it. It felt kind of like dynamic and energetic. But he also, some of the shots just felt very, just very beautiful and very artistic. So not to leap around too much, but when we kind of are introduced to Boz outside the motel and he's there and then the door opens and you have this beautiful half-dressed woman, that felt like a poster. It felt like a print. It felt like Edward Hopper. Like there was something going on in that shot that was just utterly stunning. And so yeah, full marks for that one, because that was beautiful.
And the show seems to, and this is where I love comparing the show to The Americans, I think I'm not the only one, just because of setting and look and feel to a different extent. The Americans is always, it always takes place in the winter. You can tell it's like Washington DC, it's colder, the trees are dead. The show seems to, based on lighting and based on some of the environments that we now get to see, the show seems to be based more in the autumn and in the fall.
Yeah.
And we see this as Boz is driving through this sort of beautiful lake, sort of there's forest scenery. And I think that's really nice, because it continues with this kind of like warmth and color palette that we see like in Cardiff, outside of Cardiff, like in the basement, outside the basement.
It absolutely, it gives us the combination of green and gold, because this is what we've seen from the show from the start, is green and gold and then highlights of red, right? So all these kind of late summer, early autumn colors that are coming through. And I actually wrote down, it's funny you mentioned it, I wrote down my thoughts, even Boz's car is green in front of his friend's yellow house.
Yeah.
Am I imagining this? It's just such a strong color vibe that I'm beginning to think I'm looking for things that aren't there. But it's those combinations just keep coming up over and over again. And I really love them.
I think this episode felt really emotional to me in the sense that a lot was, not just because of Boz's sort of son and the dynamic with the wife, but Joe and Sarah together with Gordon and Donna, where I think it started very superficially. And then when there's this whole confrontation, like things get really emotional. And I think that was bound to happen, right? Because so far in the episodes, things have been a little bit colder. Like there's no sense of one way or another sympathy or sort of despise or anything like that towards the characters. Everyone's just trying to get on with whatever they're trying to get on with. But now it feels like more's put in the line than before, from a personal point of view. So like Gordon commenting on, and I know we're skipping ahead a little bit, but Gordon commenting on the fact that he does put money behind this project, that he's sort of taken time out of whatever genius idea he could have had to help on this thing that he actually ended up causing more problems with. So it does feel like there's a lot of emotions, like emotions are basically running high. And there's some really nice touching moments in it too. And I felt like that was really well done.
Absolutely. And so the very first line of notes that I wrote down, because I scribble things down while I'm watching and then sort of think of some things afterwards. The very first thing I wrote down is, so Donna's become Gordon, Gordon's becoming Cameron, Joe has become Donna, and Cameron's become Joe. Is that sustainable? And I think we know by the end of the episode that it absolutely isn't. Like Gordon's shot at becoming Cameron absolutely goes up in flames. And Joe's sort of attempt to be more Donna-like is just not fooling anyone. So it's fascinating that we start out with these kinds of dynamics, but they break before we even get to the end of the episode, which I think is really, really interesting. It's like that this underlying message all the way through is like, can you change or do you just become more yourself? Is really, really interesting. And yeah, I really had a lot of time for this episode. And when they talk about it being called The Way In, it does feel like they are finding the way in to more classic Hold and Catch Fire episodes. I like it a lot.
Going back to what you said about Boz and some of the scenes, I wrote down that there's like a noir quality to Boz in movement, in acting, in setting, especially when he's in his car sort of overlooking when his son is getting married. And not just that, but there's sort of like a noir quality around how the events unfold, which is great because we're not told, like at first I wrote down, Boss with a prostitute? No way, it's his wife. And like, yeah, they're in a motel and things are unfolding in a way that are actually really interesting and not in ways that are hammered into your head. Like we've seen sometimes, right, with the symbolism or some of the other stuff, but everything starts to unfold. And yeah, there's just like a quality to him that I found to be so nice and textured in relation to some of the other characters that are like fast-paced, chaotic, or confrontational.
Absolutely. And I liked the insight we got into his wife. Like we don't know anything about her really. We get a very strong impression of her from this. And it's an unexpected one for the time, right? I mean, we're talking about an 80s time where there's a lot of films coming out with kind of like power women and this and that and the other. And there's a kind of interesting vibe of what a career woman looks like that's kind of coalescing at this time. And she, on the one hand, we know that she's what, a flight attendant. And so you sort of, whatever stereotypes kind of jostle for
yeah, worldly
proximity in your head, kind of, or like a priority in your head kind of happen there. But she's obviously in her 40s. Obviously, she looks absolutely amazing. Like the woman's got, the figure of a teenager, but it's just really nice to see a woman in her 40s on screen who is considered an attractive and interesting. You don't get that in many shows, even now. And so that was really nice from that point of view. And it was lovely to see that, in this scenario, she is pulling the strings and she's the one letting him down gently and being like, this isn't a return to form. This is a nice way of saying goodbye, really. This is a nice way of keeping you at arm's length. And it's heartbreaking, but it's just really well handled.
It is. And again, going back to hitting that reset button, this positions Boss in a different light where, you know, we already see that he's kind of telling Cameron, like, I'm not really cut out to do or be what you want me to be in this setting that you've sort of established and you created in this world. And then with the wife and the son, it's like this kind of passage of like, here's the car, which is the last thing that I sort of treasured before I left. Yeah. I love that we see Barry back because there's a lot more affinity with someone like him than, for example, Stan, which is Gordon's Dungeons and Dragons friend from like the last episode, because yes, he feels really corny and like cliched, whereas some of these people feel like they've been friends for a long time.
Yeah, and it's that difference between people that you're friends with because you're friends and people that you're friends with because you've known them for a long time.
Right.
And I feel like Gordon hasn't quite realized that Stan is just someone he's known for a long time. Whereas Barry genuinely is kind of putting his money where his mouth is. Like in this world where so many of these people, like Nathan Cardiff's never going to turn around and hold out a hand to anyone.
No.
In this world where so many people are just looking out for themselves, Barry is a true friend. Like he is actually trying. And his friend went to prison and he still stepped up and helped him. And that's actually quite touching. But yeah, there's this whole kind of realization that Boss comes to. There's even some like, actually, to go back to the motel a minute, there's a beautiful bit of camera work where he sort of wakes up or she's getting dressed after they've slept together and the camera is tilted and then rights itself. And it's like Boz's world has tipped up and then pulled itself back into some sort of stability. And this constant thing that he's trying to do, he's trying to find what his next step is. And it's not like Gordon where it's frenetic and messy and Gordon can't find his way through it and it's all chaotic. With Boz, it's just like, it's like a seesaw or like being on the deck of a ship. He's just kind of trying to find the midpoint, the stability, the balance, but in a much slower, more jaded, maybe more patient, more wise way than Gordon.
The camera really comes into its own in moments like these, really, because, you know, you go from handheld and mutiny where it's kind of like shaky and moving around to really static camera work, like what you're describing, that then tilts and but it's still like a static camera, right? And I feel like the directors that have come on the show have really used that sort of use that tool to really be able to tell us whether we are watching something directly in relation to how a character feels versus being on the outside and just experiencing a scene between a lot of people or different things. We also get a lot of quick shots and really tight shots with Joe when he's in, I mean, clearly to illustrate how stifled and trapped he is in that basement. But again, this could have been done from a lot of different ways. And the show really does come into its own when it can really use camera work to demonstrate some of these things. And actually, I'm a sucker for like a quick montage or like a quick setup with some with a really good track, etc. And I feel like this is why the episode also sort of did it for me. You know, in the first 4 minutes, we already see what each character is up to in a quick succession of shots with some music, and it's all very dynamic. And I feel like that's the energy that the show really excels at, I think, even though it can sometimes feel more manipulated, more TV. You're exposing more of an editing process versus something that is more organic. And I know I talk a lot about, we always talk about like tons of different shows. And, you know, I've done a lot of research around what is more cinematic versus what is more TV. It tends to be that cable and now I guess streaming shows take the liberty with more cinematic elements where you can have like a long pause for a long time and be more a little bit more artistic to let it breathe because there's not the same amount of pressure. But I've always found shows like The Good Wife, which are network 22 episode seasons, to be really good at just having pauses and characters look at each other and not have to be that fast paced. So anyway, I think it's really cool when the show is able to do a little bit of both.
Well, I think you also tap into something there, which is just something that the show is very good at doing and gets better at over time, is knowing how much time to spend with something. So they're short seasons, it's 10 episodes. And we can't leave Joe in that basement for very long for lots of reasons. One, because there aren't that many episodes to go. Two, because he's Joe. You don't get that much static stuff with Joe. You can't sell it for that long. And three, because it would be boring for right for everyone watching if he was stuck. And they use that claustrophobia. They use those tight shots to make it feel like he's been down there for much longer in terms of screen time than he actually has. You get the sense of the length of time that he has felt pressured down there, so that by the end of the episode, when he's already making a strike to get out, and he's kind of figured out his way in or out, depending on how you look at it.
Yeah.
It feels like he's earned it. It doesn't feel like, oh, well, hang on a minute. Yeah. He was only put in the basement in the last episode and now he's coming out again. I mean, what the hell? But they've built it out so well, and they've spent just enough time down there, and they've kind of developed just enough of a sense of it and used the camera to make it feel very small and petty. And I love that then it feels earned at the end. And while we're in there, just to talk about not just the visuals, but also the writing, I absolutely love the observation of Joe's manager, because I know it feels a bit obvious that this man is speaking in the most like bizarre corporate coded language, but we've all worked in offices. We know people really do that.
Yes.
And he says things like, I was fortunate to obtain, and I trust you'll comply. And then you get these like mixed in with these strands.
Pre-email.
Yeah. You get these mixed strands of Texas slang as well. Like, ain't exactly hair raising. And It reminded me a bit of Gary Cole in Office Space, but except that in this case, this guy's not even middle management. He's like a supervisor of a basement, but he has turned into, could I just have that, you know, TPS report? He's just so awful, but so brilliantly observed. And he spends so little time on screen, but he's so memorable. And yeah, I loved the writing in that and the performance.
He's very much like the Printer Brothers from Comdex in season one, I think, right? That level of kind of like, not quirky, but like memorable in the sense that the person is just completely bland. And you know that Joe will supersede him.
Yeah, this guy has no ambition. And like, he has found his place and he's very comfortable. And it's almost done, and maybe this is down to the performance, but it's almost affectionate. It's almost like, yeah, he's awful, but he's happy. You know, and when Jacob sort of talks about getting rid of the team and installing his own team, I actually was like, I hope he doesn't lose his job. I hope Dreadful Office Guy still has his job, because he's so comfortable with his ducks. You know, he's so happy.
I did have thoughts about that, actually, because if you remember season one, one of the first few episodes, Joe made Gordon the head of whatever. It made him fire a lot of his own colleagues and teammates. And so he didn't get his hands dirty. And it feels like this is kind of the same thing.
Oh, yeah. And comeuppance.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I wrote down something like, oh, once again, Joe is hit with the magic privilege wand and he gets a whole department fired so that he can do his thing. And I don't know if that's Jacob being Jacob on purpose versus Joe being purely brilliant. I was kind of annoyed at that to an extent, because I wish that Joe could have a little bit more emotion into it. His real challenge should be, how does he turn these people into workhorses? But
I have to say, this episode does really well in tackling office dynamics.
Yeah.
Like the dynamic between the person who is brighter than their manager, the boss who comes in and stirs things up. But also at Mutiny, you get the same thing as well. So the game pitch session is like, okay, so anybody listening to this who has also worked in marketing and done a creative thing and then put it out to, I mean, I've often worked actually with brilliant account directors, but sometimes you get brand managers, account directors, particularly I think the mid-level ones who
feel like they have to say something.
Yeah, they've got to say something so that they get to be senior. It's that awful, incredibly freaking literal feedback that you get that is, even when the product is bad, and obviously some of these pitches are hysterically bad, it's still soul destroying when people are just incredibly literal.
And nitpicky.
And like, actually, even though Lev's idea is terrible, when he's like, my Jell-O is not moldy, I kind of felt for him because I was like, no, man, you stick up for your Jell-O.
Well, we talked about this in the last episode, right? Like, what's already created, think you can sprinkle that fairy dust, and what do you have to build from scratch? Because it's very easy to take these things out of context and feel like no one's thought them through before they pitch them. And I feel like that's where it really kind of hurts, because you're kind of putting something out there for someone that is coming in without any context and just tearing it apart, just based on personal point of view, which feels very real.
Absolutely. And it really just highlights how, like, every creative is made better for having feedback from people who know what they're talking about. Like, every single one of us, novelists are better for their editors. You know, everyone is better for having somebody else come in and go, ooh, what about this? But the kind of feedback you need, and interestingly, it's what Tom comes up with when he's talking Cameron through her panic attack, which we'll talk about in a second. The kind of feedback you need needs to understand where you're coming from and where you want to go. It can't be this sort of external, like, but what if that was green? You know, that's not helpful. That's not feedback. That's nitpicking and subjectivity.
Yeah, I'm missing the point.
What you want is somebody to understand your feeling and go, okay, I don't think you've taken us to 100 yet. I think you're at 80. And here are some interesting things, ways that you could look at it that could get you there. You do wonder, is Joe is actually has always been very good at inspiring people, but now that he's going to create his own team and do his own thing, is he going to be good at that? Is he going to get people to find their 100? Or is he just going to be like, I know what the vision is, just come with me and, you know, keep up if you can? Because that's not my favorite thing.
So the panic attack.
I loved a lot about this. So lots of things going on here. First of all, the sound editing and the sound mapping, the tinnitus sound during the whole panic attack was incredibly effective.
Yeah.
Big Mackenzie Davis appreciation moment.
Yes.
She is so good. She neither over nor undersells it. It's just pitch perfect and really kind of just visceral. She does it so beautifully. But also the writing. So Tom talking her down, like we were just talking about the pitch session and how everyone was being awful. And obviously he is deeply obnoxious because he can see the problems, but he's just not very good at explaining.
Yeah, offering up those solutions.
Yeah. He's being like, being Steve McQueen in The Great Escape with his ball against the wall, you know, he's doing that. And he's not being constructive. And then he gets to the heart of it and he comes out with the most important, most understandable bit of feedback. And when he goes, make him human again. And it's the first time that he has acted really human, because we've only really seen him as this snippy, uptight, difficult, poking holes in everything, too full of himself person. And now he softens and you see a way in and you go, oh, so you are also capable of being human again. And which is wonderful. And like that whole moment just encapsulated a lot of the different themes for me in the episode about, you know, people finding their way, people breaking under pressure, the difference between understanding there is a problem and coming up with a way to solve it. So much of it was in that moment for me. And I just thought that was the highlight for me of the episode.
Yeah. And I love that he was able to really calm her down by speaking the same language and sort of reassuring her of the things that she knows and she's done, right? Like, walk me through the game. Like, what do you need to do and what do you need next? And that's kind of like that inspiration. That's that light bulb moment as well, right? How do we get past this moment to continue to innovate? And how much does that innovation matter in a world where it'll go to someone else to figure out whether they like it or not, right? It's not about, like, your self-innovation is not the same thing as what a consumer wants or is expecting to see. And I think that's going to be a really interesting pull and push going forward. Something that I really wanted to touch on is Jacob's office and how that compares to someone like Boss's office from season one.
Oh, yes.
You can tell where the money is, right? Just because you have this sort of big, blinds wide open office versus what Boss has.
Yeah. And also it's interesting because there's a lot of similar colors,
yes,
but they're used very differently. So Boss's office always felt like it had all the browns and things, but it felt a little bit dark.
Yeah.
A little bit oppressive, but also like there was a lot of unused empty space. Oh, you kind of cross this desert to get to this desk, which is a bit separate from everything. Jacob's office has obviously so much more detail. There are so many more things in it. There's a sense of a man who has lived his career in this office.
An experience,
And who is wearing his trappings on the outside. It's like, look at all that I have built. He is very big on, you can see he's very big on legacy.
Yeah.
Like, I have built something, I've given it, you know, it's not quite, I've given it my name, but it's because it's West Group, not Wheeler Group, but still you get the sense that he's like, he's kind of peed in every corner of that office, right? He's living and breathing it. And it has this sort of much more of a sense of kind of polished wood and riches and detail and quality. But it also, like, despite the light and despite the quality, it does feel a lot smaller than Boz's office. It feels like the outlook is smaller. So he's done all these things. He's done all this wonderful stuff, but he is coming basically to the end of his trajectory. Industry, which I think in the last episode, Sarah says something like it. I think she trots out Joe's tagline, doesn't she, of like an industry built on fossils, literally. And so he's coming to the end of his moment and Joe is at the beginning of his. And it's just quite striking, the kind of visual differences between what Joe's world is going to look like, which is quite cool and clinical and broad, and what Jacob's world has always looked like, which is small and elegant and cloistered. And I mean, it's very fascinating to me that, you know, we've talked about two very tall actors, and Jacob stays seated for Joe's pitch, which changes again the dynamic of how we see Joe as this, like, I love the fact that everyone who's come in has gone, we have got a freaking enormous guy playing Joe, he's so tall, let's just use it. And I love that they use it, because you know, I just think it would be a massive waste not to. And yeah, obviously, Lee Pace is a beautiful human, probably on the inside.
Lee Pace appreciation
moment. He's probably a beautiful human on the inside as well, with his conservation work and all the rest of it. So we should mention that.
Yes.
You know, they just use his physical presence really, really well throughout the entire show, actually, but particularly in this episode.
Well, this is the interesting thing, right? And let's talk about the elephant in the room, which is Sarah.
Yeah.
Because
the tiniest woman in the world, by the way. Which is fascinating.
Because
she packs an awful lot of presence into the tininess, to give her full credit.
She does, but we're talking about characters introduced in this, or reintroduced in this episode, like Jacob, like Boz's ex-wife, or wife, because we don't know they're fully divorced. I think he's on the papers. But Sarah, she's... I don't know how I feel about her, because she does pack a lot of presence, but she is very peripheral to Joe in a sense that all her actions or reactions are in relation to him and the situations that he's in, even though she's got a lot to do with that, right? From the point of view of like putting him in that place, etc. But that whole dinner scene.
Yeah, she's a really difficult one to peg, because episode one, she seemed to be the only person prepared to call Joe on his shit. And then episode two, you get her more as a sort of supportive presence who is willing to kind of, like, she trots out some of his taglines and she is defensive of him to her dad.
Yeah.
And then in this episode, she just seems very cagey, very dissatisfied. She spots, like, Joe cannot help going straight into a pitch. As soon as he sees Gordon and Donna, he like falls back into old patterns. And then she challenges him on it. And interestingly, he does go, he can't help telling the truth when she challenges him on it. So we're still finding our feet with Sarah, because so many of her reactions are in, you're right, she's so much of her is reactions to people around her. She's reacting to her dad. She's reacting to Joe. We know that she's a journalist. We know that there's some stuff going on. We know that she's had this her ex-husband, another man that she's sort of reacting to after the fact. And she's cagey and she doesn't trust everyone. I don't feel like we know who she is yet.
She feels very much like this very cliched West Coast life guru that will pull him aside and say, you didn't tell the truth today. After rehab type thing, you didn't tell the truth today. Go back and tell the truth. Did you tell them that you didn't fire all these people because of what you did with my... Like,
but also she's grainier than that. Like, she's not goopy.
No.
She's not a kind of like, oh, and we must always tell the truth to ourselves. She's,
right. So this is what I don't understand.
Yeah, she's more beaten down by life. I feel like she has been there, done that, and lied to herself, and she's not going to let anyone else do it.
But I guess, like, what are her intentions in relation to, like, inviting Gordon and Dana? Because if she's caged around them, or the opposite, if she's like, go tell them the truth, because these people, like, what are you trying to make up for with these two individuals that you know stuff went down? And how much do you know of that stuff that went down? It felt really weird in terms of, like, her coming in, them coming in through the door and being like, oh, hello, like, so nice to finally meet you. And then, like, being really, I don't know. There was just something really odd about that, those moments.
Yeah. It was. And I loved how the whole thing was so deeply uncomfortable.
Well, yeah.
That was really done.
Finally, at dinner, remember the hurricane episode, like, where Gordon actually shows up,
yes,
and he's there. And I did love, just a little bit of parenthesis, I loved the fact that they kept listening to the voicemail, and that there's all these little moments to appreciate the technology of the time, right? Like, which was like listening to a recording of a voicemail.
Yes.
I thought that was great.
Yeah. And I mean, you mentioned the hurricane episode. I kind of loved that, you know, they turn up overdressed, and it's,
yeah,
a wonderful reversal of Joe and his Italian,
yes,
shoes.
Yes.
You know, it's like they've turned up looking just a little bit too good. And then this kind of revelation that they are well off, working on new projects, and Joe does not get any money out of Cardiff and is in a basement and has taken up with this mysterious and slightly hard to crack journalist lady. Like, there's so much in there that it's just so hugely awkward. And yeah, I love watching uncomfortable stuff and then I feel uncomfortable.
It works.
A very weird thing.
I think what really works in this episode versus maybe the last one is a narrative structure that really is more designed around cause and effect, right? So once we see Gordon in the beginning sort of ideating and drinking this thing and coming up with all these things, that will have an impact later down in the episode that will tangle up the situation with Joe, where Dana can't attend to help out Cameron. Cameron has this breakdown. Like, this is, I think, where the show really excels. And I feel like that's the thing that was really well done in this episode. And it's not just down to pacing and editing. It really is down to the narrative structure that really allows for the story to unfold, mm-hmm, in this way. And because there was a set order to things, like, this needed to happen before the next,
yes,
thing.
I loved their rich awareness of the parallels they're building. I love the deliberateness of that. I love that Boz's moment with his son, which almost feels like it comes from another show.
Yes.
Not in a bad way. Like, it adds a dimension that I really liked. But then you've got this rich, complicated reconciliation moment. And then he gives away the only part of his old life that he has left. Like, we know that the car was kind of important to him, but also that he's made his peace with it and he's giving it away. And he's made the decision that he needs to make. But it's a reconciliation, right? His son accepts the gift graciously after having been a bit, like, edgy at first. And clearly they don't have a completely mended relationship, but it's something. Like, they're both willing to work on this. And then minutes after that, Donna walks away from Gordon to go and deal with the problem that he's created and kind of leaves him on the doorstep. And it's just, I love that they unfolded those things in the right order, that just as you're left with this glow of, oh, maybe Boz is kind of reaching into the past and going, I wasn't the dad I should have been, I'm going to try and do better now. And his son going, all right, then I'll give you the chance to do that. And then Gordon is just like kind of going, I've done a thing. I'm so proud of myself. It goes so horrifically wrong. And Donna doesn't look back. Like, she just goes and sorts the problem out because the problem is now more important to her, I think, than Gordon. And meanwhile, she doesn't know, that he is physically beginning to echo his mental breakdown. Like, he is physically beginning to break down now.
I think in relation to the boss scenes, we also get a reminder that this is someone that went to jail and had a bigger impact in those around them above and beyond Cardiff. Because looking back at season one, I think we mentioned the fact that it felt kind of weird and kind of like, so did he go to jail? Is he going to come back? And we get why that had to be in the background a little bit, because in the grand scheme of things, you know, a lot of those discussions and plotting happened off camera. And it's nice to sort of call back to those moments and feel like there are like unfinished things that were happening in season one that we didn't see. And I always think that those are sort of like worthy moments, and they don't spend too much time with it. They do it in a clever way. And yeah, I feel like it helps the episode overall.
But I also like that we see in Boz an appreciation of sacrifice. Like so often in these things, you see it through the mum who doesn't get to spend time with her kids. But now we're seeing the impact of the dad who did what dads are supposed to do, right? Go into work, did all the things, put it all out on the line for his career. And it wasn't there for the moments that mattered. And the fact that his son, now fully grown and starting a family of his own, is still hurt by that. And like, it has a lasting impact. And what's fascinating about that is just as Boz is beginning to come to terms with the fact that, you know, he made the sacrifices he made for good or bad, right or wrong, those happened. He can't take them back, but he can choose to try and build those relationships in the future. Cameron, meanwhile, has absolutely no appreciation for what Donna sacrifices. She doesn't care, really, that Donna hasn't seen her husband or kids for days at a time. Weirdly, Cameron is actually acting very much like the kind of sexist VC that they met in the episode before, basically just writing off the idea that Donna might have any priorities that aren't work.
Because it's a choice. You choose to not go see your family. She sees it like that, right? Like, you choose to not go and see your family. You choose to be here all day.
Yeah. And they'll cope. They'll be fine. They'll deal with it. And actually, that kind of slightly toxic culture is a culture that startups still very much have.
Yeah, of course.
So what's quite nice about a complete lack of kind of appreciation is that at the very least, she appreciates Donna's work when she gets to work. So she only shows that appreciation like a weapon. She never says to Donna, you're doing great stuff, you're doing things. She'll only say it to Gordon as a weapon to go, ugh, you're useless, your wife is doing things.
Yeah, that shows that she cares about Donna, like that she knows there's more there. Like, she's defending Donna.
Well, there's respect. There's respect that we haven't seen her show directly to Donna's face.
Yeah.
And especially in the context of the last two episodes where she keeps doing things behind Donna's back. She keeps making unilateral decisions without involving her. She, you know, says that she's going to be better at it and then isn't. And kind of learns to say thank you, but you're not entirely sure that it's genuine. Finally seeing, this is why. In the same way that we used to go, oh, this is why Donna's married to Gordon. Now we go, oh, this is why Cameron has invited Donna into her life. There is a core of like respect and admiration that sits under what they're doing. And I like that even in the midst of Cameron being like massively unappreciative to Donna's face, that did still come through. And it makes you understand why Donna is bothering to do all this, why she's still buying into this culture. It is about the work, but it is also about the fact that she is finding a meeting of minds there that she's not getting anywhere else. Because she could go and do her engineering work anywhere. She's got the skills. She could go and apply and do, she could go to another Cardiff. She could do all that stuff. But this, she wants to create something in a place where she has respect for other people who are creating something. So that, yeah, that I liked.
That brings me to a thought that I had, which is around Donna's clothing throughout the whole episode, which is just stripes. In the last scene, we see the lighting on her, cutting her into stripes, basically. Also very noir, by the way, like the whole blinds and detective office, private eye vibes. But I thought that was really interesting because I'm like, is there a duality to Donna above and beyond,
yes,
the obvious mother, wife of Gordon, and
love it,
business partner to Cameron? Or is there more? Is it going to be a situation where these two are going to start to have to compete outside of this environment because that is the only way to survive? Like, how much are they going to stick with each other? And I feel like these signs are very telling, right? Because we do have like Donna and her usual like pink stripes and white and not quite full red.
Yep.
Like, you can see it in Donna. She's kind of fed up and she's really frustrated. But her drive to keep going is out of, I think, having to fix this problem in a way that is above and beyond just like,
definitely,
whether the server works or doesn't.
And look, we had the visionary and the builder relationship with Gordon and Joe. But the kind of message that we got at the end of season one is that maybe Joe isn't the visionary that he thinks he is. And maybe Gordon isn't the builder that he could be. Like, you know, they are both compromised in some way. Like, Joe's vision was compromised at the end by wanting to sell the product. Gordon's vision was a bit compromised by wanting to just get something out of the door. And it wasn't, you know, he never, it was in the same way that the Symphonic never really happened. It's that kind of like stunted realization thing. Here we've got two women, which brings in a different perspective again, because obviously they're going to face challenges that the men didn't face. But you've got the same roles. You've got Cameron as visionary and you've got Donna as engineer, but we have been set up to think that Cameron's vision is more authentic than Joe's, that she is more committed to the authenticity.
Yeah, it's more organic.
Yeah, she can do stuff, which Joe can't. He can think stuff, but he can't do. She can think and do. And, you know, she has really set herself apart as I am going to be an original thinker and a unique thinker, and that matters to her. And in Donna's case, we see somebody who is more practical than Gordon, who thinks about her audience, who thinks about the consumer, who wants to sell what she's doing and wants to tailor it and target it to how people are already behaving, and has quite a sort of forward-thinking view of her building. Are they going to be better at it? Is their visionary builder dynamic going to, like, even though they are already at each other's throats quite a lot of the time, is there... It ultimately, in a work context, is that going to work better than Gordon and Joe, who were still trying to fit into more of a corporate hierarchy and who were more advanced in their careers and no one's really said no to them up until this point? You know, is it going to turn out that there is more substance to Donna and Cameron than there was to the men that came before them? Don't know, but it's an interesting question.
It's interesting. And also, how much can they get done in that space also geographically, right? Like Stan's mentioning California again. Joe wanted to go to California, now he can't. Like, we keep hearing about Silicon Valley, and it's going to get to a point when we're seeing all these outside forces have an impact, like copies of the game propping up and the fact that they're running out of users, et cetera. So how is that going to play out? And just a quick side note on Joe and his environment that reminds me a lot of Enlightened, which is a show that I don't know if you've seen.
I have not. I don't think I've ever heard of it.
Oh, it's such a hidden gem. 2 seasons, HBO.
I need to hand in my nerd card, man.
Oh, man. No, it's Laura Dern.
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, who doesn't love Laura Dern? And if exactly. You don't, stop listening. Go away. Learn to like her. Come back.
Exactly. She is, you know, the quick one is that she works in a corporate job, has basically a mental breakdown, and comes back to this company months later after rehab and goes, why are we working in this corporate structure that doesn't give back to the world and its users and all that stuff? And she tries to persuade higher-ups to change and to care about the environment and all these things. And she gets put in this basement surrounded by all these servers. And it really reminds me of the setting that Joe finds himself in. And her whole thing is about and she's got this manager that's very much like Joe's manager, who is like, no, sit down. You can only have a 15-minute break. You can't use your phone. You can't do all these things. And she tries to influence the people around her to start being so numb. And it's just a really interesting situation where she's got all these servers around her that have the information that she can use to make something better, kind of like that light bulb moment that Joe was having. So anyway, I thought that was like an interesting parallel.
Oh, no, absolutely. And it takes me actually to something that I really appreciated when you talk about Joe's light bulb moment. Like, he literally steps into the light. Like, yeah. He steps into the light. He is only comfortable. Really, he only feels like himself. He only takes up his full space when he's around the computers. His brain, like, there's a music cue as his brain kind of comes online and the computers come to life and he hears the whirring and the tapping, and is literally like Joe himself is rebooting. Everything about that I thought was really elegant. And while it wasn't, I don't know if you can call it original or not, it was still beautifully done. And so therefore, I didn't care whether it was original. I just thought it was lovely.
I think in the context of the show, it really works. And the nail on the head where the rebooting, it feels like with Mutiny basically virtually losing all their subscribers, with, you know, Boss handing in the car, with Gordon coming clean and about the fact that he's helping pay for all these debts, and Donna feeling she's making a decision. I really do wonder, and we do not remember where it's going to take us. And I think Joe suddenly becomes a lot more interesting from this point of view, right?
Definitely. And it's a really bold salvo, I think, three episodes into a new series to evoke the halt and catch fire command and watch everything burn down. Like, this is three episodes in. There's another seven episodes to go in this season. And we've already seen one potential spark, like, literally go up in flames. So, where are you going to go from that so early in a season?
No, 100%. And I loved also that this episode also brings back a lot of night scenes and there's a lot of shadows and the music. I mean, I must be a sucker for this, but the music sort of lingers. And I feel like that's what gives it that emotional edge that I was talking about in the beginning that we are missing from some of the other episodes. And they do bring it in when they need to. I think the more they do, the better, I think, because it really does carry it forward. And you know, that last scene with Cameron sort of crying on her desk and trying to figure her out with the camera really close in on her, it's just heartbreaking. With the music, with the way that the camera's panning, if we see more of these kinds of episodes throughout the season, it's going to be sort of way better than what we've seen so far from the point of view of like really connecting with those emotional points at the right times.
Absolutely. I think the first couple of episodes had to establish a lot of plot and a lot of introductions and a lot of people. But now you're right. You said at the beginning of this episode, it's emotional. We're into rich territory now. We've established everyone. Now we can get to know them better. I'd like to get to know Sarah better. I still don't feel like I know who she is yet. I'd like to get to know Jacob a bit better. Yeah, I'd like to get to know Jacob a bit better because at the moment he's just like a bit old school, a bit manipulative. But maybe it's just because I like James Cromwell, but I feel like there's more under the surface there. But it's interesting because I mean, like, I've probably said everything I need to say about this episode now, but the last episode we talked for quite a long time, even though we weren't sure about all the bits in it. This episode, we love everything. We kind of have less to say. Because we love everything? Isn't that weird?
It's weird, but again, I feel like it's down to the construction of the episodes. And I feel like when it's more all over the place, we have to like dissect it a little bit more than maybe this. But yeah, it was a great episode. And this one did leave me with the sort of like, right, what's next?
Yes. Yeah, this time I didn't watch it back to back. I stopped at that point and went, okay, yeah, we're going to go back to normal programming after this. But I really wanted to continue. And I was kicking myself that I wasn't binge watching it this time.
Yep.
So from the next episode, I guess we'll have had a little bit of more of a break between episodes. And that'll be an interesting perspective. Again, what happens when you kind of drop it for a week or so and leave that space in between.
Okay, so I think this brings us to a natural conclusion of the episode.
It does.
Thank you all so much for watching. You can find us, as always, in any of your podcast app of choice, including YouTube, if that's where you like to listen to podcasts. So do keep an eye out and please subscribe and leave us a review if you're enjoying hearing us geek out about the show.
Please do. And also, if you have questions and things that don't fit into your review, you can find us on Twitter at TTTGYTTT. We are there occasionally bothering Chris Cantwell, but he's very gracious about it. and we'd like you to bother us, and we promise to be gracious about it. Thanks so much for listening and sticking with us.
Thank you so much, and we'll catch you on the next one.